Afternoon. My name is Pam Blevins-Hinkel, and it's my privilege to serve as the director of the Spirit and Place Festival on behalf of our 2013 Steering Committee and Advisory Board, as well as the Polis Center, part of the IU School of Liberal Arts at IUPUI. I welcome you here to this closing event of the 2013 Spirit and Place Festival, which celebrated the theme of... Wow, Heidi, you really got them primed. That's awesome. Let's have another hand for Modus. Dance. And we've got more experiences for you in RISC that we'd like to invite you to beyond today. In your program, you'll find some information about an event in December called Asterisk that's being put on by our partners at WFYI, Well Done Marketing, and LISC, which invites you to visit six new places around the city and then to come and celebrate and share your experiences, and you'll be receiving more information from us about that. And I invite you to check out your program for more information. There are a number of individuals and institutions that I'd like to thank, and I'm going to get to that in a second. But first, I have one little bit of risky thing for you to try. Nothing like this, though. You look awesome. I need to teach you a little chant, a little cheer. It's something I need you to remember today throughout the presentation. And also, as you leave this place, I really need you to carry this with you when you go from here. And so I'm going to divide the group up into two parts. This is part one and part two. Okay, so here you go. Part one, are you ready? Yeah, you're sure?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's your part. I'm going to do it. You're going to repeat it. Call and response. Okay, here it is. IUSPINDY.
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 Okay, quick learners. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, your part is 2222. Yes!
2222. Yes!
2222, yes!
2222, yes!
Okay, now we're going to put it together. Are you ready? Here we go. You start. IUSP 2222, yes!
IUSPINDY 2222,
come on.
Yes! IUSPINDY 2222, yes! IUSPINDY
2222, yes! Awesome! Great. Give yourselves a hand. And so now, if you're wondering what that particular bit of silliness might be about, slide, please. Oh, that's really not what it's supposed to be. So, speaking of risk, so what that is a way for you to contribute $10 to Spirit and Place by texting
I-U-S-P-N-D-2-20-2-20.
And then when you get the authorization request, you answer?
Yes.
Oh, see, isn't that great? All right. So, we invite you to make a cut. There it is. Wow. Okay, that's interesting. So, thank you in advance for supporting Spirit and Place. The festival depends on the partnership and contributions of numerous individuals and organizations in our community. We can't do it without you. Over 95% of our budget comes from charitable contributions. And I want to take a minute now to say thank you to some important people and support organizations who've been so instrumental this year in helping us to celebrate RISC. There are three particular folks that I want to draw attention to. The first is our honorary chair this year, Scott Jones, who is a great role model for risk-taking in our community and beyond. Through conversations with Scott and other community leaders early in the year, we were inspired to take our own risk and plan a very unique opening event, and in both our opening and closing events, to lift up both well-known and lesser-known risk takers that we have right here in central Indiana. Scott, we thank you for your leadership and for your generosity this year. I also want to thank a woman who I've had the pleasure of working with now for 8 years at Spirit in Place, and that's our program coordinator, Jennifer Gillis. It's her organizational skills and her beautiful spirit that make it a joy to come to work, and that many partners benefit from her skill and for her great care during the year. Jennifer, thank you so very much. And I also want to acknowledge our outgoing advisory board chair, David Wants, who has been on the board now for 6 years, the last two as chair. David, your passion and enthusiasm for Spirit in Place has inspired me continuously, and I know that it has many others. Thank you for your leadership. I also want to acknowledge our partners here today. We're very grateful to our hosts here at the Indianapolis Public Library and to WFYI, the Scott A. Jones Foundation, and also, again, Modus Dance and Ankh Movies, who are help making this day a marvelous experience for all of you. And I also want to acknowledge our major festival partners, Lilly Endowment, the Alan Whitehill Clues Charitable Foundation, the Scott Jones Foundation, Bolson Group, IUPUI, the Indianapolis Foundation, the CICF Fund, and the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Would you please join me in thanking all of them, please? It takes so many people, so many partners, to allow Spirit in Place to do what it does, which is to build stronger and more vibrant communities. Over the last 18 years, Spirit in Place has partnered with over 600 community organizations to create never-before-seen programs for over 250,000 people. These programs generate new ideas, transcend differences, and help spark collective action for the common good. We believe that it is in the crucible of conversation and creativity and collaboration that we can move forward together. We believe that it's in that space, in that place, where we can learn from one another, where we can shrink the space between us, and where we can dare one another to imagine a better life for our communities. So let's get today's conversation started. Would you please join me in welcoming our moderator, Kevin Armstrong, Sarah Fisher, David Baker, Phil Gully, and Scott Jones.
You all had the moves on. It was really impressive to watch out there. Well, I assume that you have come tonight because you want to hear from the speakers and not about them. So I hope you'll forgive very brief introductions of each of our speakers. You can read more about them in your program. This is going to be the moderator's equivalent of tweeting their bios. At the age of 19, Sarah Fisher became the youngest woman to qualify for the Indianapolis 500, the first woman to win a pole position for major open wheel racing, and her lightning quick lap of 221 miles per hour remains the fastest lap at the Kentucky Speedway. She's completed the most 500 starts of any woman in history, and today she's a team owner in Izod IndyCar Series. In 2011, she became the first female team owner to win a race in that series. I'm interested to hear whether some of this risk-taking is genetic. Her grandmother was an aviator in Ohio, and her aunt was third in command at the FAA. Welcome, Sarah Fisher. David Baker currently holds the position of Distinguished Professor of Music and Chairman of the Jazz Department at Indiana University School of Music. He has taught and performed around the world. He's recorded with the likes of Stan Kenton, Lionel Hampton, Maynard Ferguson, Quincy Jones. He's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, a Grammy, and Sarah, in case you're not aware, David has his own racing story. He's received an Emmy Award for his musical score of the PBS documentary For Gold and Glory about African-American race car drivers in the 1920s. In his spare time, he has 65 recordings, 70 books, 400 articles, and 2,000 compositions to his credit. Welcome, David Baker. Phil Gulley is a Quaker pastor, writer, and a popular speaker who's published 17 books, including the acclaimed Harmony series that many of you know about, chronicling life in that eccentric Quaker community of Harmony, Indiana. Phil and co-author Jim Mulholland risk sharing their own progressive religious views in books titled If Grace is True and If God is Love. Phil's most recent publication is The Evolution of Faith, How God is Creating a Better Christianity. Phil's also an Emmy Award winner for his show on PBS and is a regular contributor to the Saturday Evening Post. Phil, welcome. It's great to have you here. And Scott Jones describes himself as a serial entrepreneur and inventor. At age 25, he co-founded his first company and began serving as the chair and chief scientist. At Boston Technology, he obtained patents for technologies that now enable telephone companies worldwide to offer voice messaging, voicemail, on a worldwide scale to 2 billion people. Scott also founded internet-based music company Gracenote, which many of you utilize, probably whether you know it or not, on Apple, Yahoo, and Sony. He's currently the chairman, CEO, and co-founder of ChaCha, today's leading free real-time answers service. Scott's vision, that people will have access to all of humankind's knowledge from anywhere at any time. ChaCha has currently answered at least 1 billion questions worldwide. Welcome, Scott Jones. We're going to engage in conversation up here for a little bit, and then we'll turn to you for some time of questions. And then our group will leave you with a challenge about risk. So let's get started with a quick risk assessment of this group. You've all taken part in some pretty big risks in your life, financially, physically, emotionally, with your family. What would you say is one of the greater risks you've taken? And what did you learn from that experience?
Well, I guess I could start off because mine's kind of obvious, right? 230 miles an hour, well, that's kind of risky. But in actuality, it really wasn't the race car driving bit that was the risk for me. The risk for me, and granted, I've had many, many risks along the way, whether that means, you know, stepping out of a car, starting a team when I first get married when normal people have babies, or, you know, assigning a new driver to my car, or, you know, just doing the sport alone. I'd say probably the biggest risk that got me here was at 18 years old, I was enrolled at Ohio State University to follow in the footsteps of my dad, who graduated there as a mechanical engineer. And I got a call to go and take my rookie test in Las Vegas for the IndyCar series. And I think the biggest risk is when I did well at that and then got the opportunity by contract to drive for Derek Walker, I moved out of the norm, knowing, you know, what a life could provide me as a mechanical engineer and being in Ohio, to something that I had no idea where it was going to transpire to. I didn't know, you know, what the outcome of accepting an offer to drive an IndyCar would be like. I knew I had an incredible amount of fun driving cars as I had been growing up. And, you know, even though I didn't see it as a career option for me, the idea of it engaged this inner passion and desire that I just wanted to be the best that I could be in that sport. And I think that was the biggest risk, really, just driving away from my parents' home with everything I had in the back of a U-Haul van and moving into a little apartment and seeing how it goes.
And I'm guessing there are 100 things you learned from that. What sticks out?
The biggest thing that sticks out that I think we can all relate to is you just got to appreciate your parents. you know.
Wait a minute. Could you call my daughter?
you know, and there's a bunch of folks in here who probably can relate. I was that teenage girl who thought she knew it all, and I was going to go drive these great big race cars and go fast. And I didn't realize how incredible, how wonderful of a support system, you know, my parents had given me to grow up in. And when I left that house, I had no idea what the big world was waiting would be like. And, you know, I am always very thankful to have had their support. And I think a lot of kids that I talk to, some of them take that for granted who already have that. And there are kids that I've talked to who don't have that support system. And I just am always preaching, you just have to appreciate the parents.
Phil, big risk, big lesson?
I was counting on my way down here, driving over from meeting, and I was counting up the number of insurance policies I have, and I stopped at 14. I am probably the most risk-averse person in the state of Indiana. I have my insurance agent on speed dial. That's how bad it is. And so the risks I've undertaken have been, as I explained to you earlier, just a complete misreading of public opinion. So that ventures that I was passionate about, I just assumed that because I was passionate about them, particularly in theological issues, that everyone else would be too. And I did discover that they were passionate about them. But in ways that I wasn't. I remember a saying by Winston Churchill, there's nothing quite so exhilarating as being shot at and missed. And if you're ever a pastor and you have a what amounts to a heresy trial that runs year after year and occupies the entire month of August the whole time, it's every summer, and you dodge that bullet and you don't get hung or excommunicated, it's an exhilarating feeling. And what it teaches you is that all of the things you fear, when they happen to you, aren't nearly as bad as you had imagined them to be in your moments of fear. That these things happen and you can pick yourself up and dust yourself off and go forward, and life goes on and you're richer for the experience. Not financially, of course, but existentially.
Scott or David?
Where to start? I've been in trouble more times than I can count. But as an improviser, I'll give you that. Starting very, very young, learning to play an instrument, not understanding what improvisation was about, or probably even written music. And it's something that was very, very frightening. But I had teachers who cared about me and cared about students and said, "You can do this." They lied. But basically to try to figure out this great puzzle that we call improvisation. What do you do when all you've got is a piece of paper and it's got a name, the name of the song on it? And you say, "It's your time to play." That happened a number of times. I'll tell you one that left me really out of it. When I joined the Quincy Jones Band. I got in because he needed a player overnight to go to Europe. And the guy that I was going to take, wear his uniform, outweighed me by 60 or 70 pounds. So I didn't look very nice, I guess, to walk out there in front of it. But I think perhaps that one ended up, at least it was enough to laugh about. Quincy, we got to Europe and we were in, I believe it might have been France, at any rate, wherever we were. He said, why don't you go upstairs and we're going to put two to a room. I got upstairs and the door opened. A little bitty guy walked in and said, how about getting some grub, bud? I said, what? He said, how about some grub? And by this time I was out of my mind and worried about what the hell he was talking about. And it turned out this was a young man who was had learned to speak English from watching Westerns on television. So after I got out of the fright, I was already set up for whatever was going to happen next.
So I'll just chime in on, parents. So Sarah, you mentioned that, and you know, that was a really important part of my upbringing. It was kind of the freedom to take risks. So, and oftentimes probably embarrassing my parents. So anything from creating the neighborhood's haunted house to lemonade stands. Thank you everyone involved in Lemonade Day here, and the library. I was always trying to do the next big thing in the neighborhood. Sometimes that was a putt-putt course or the high jump thing or door-to-door, selling candles made out of wash rags. I was constantly doing that, and it really gave me the sense that I could charge off and do, whatever I set my mind to. So then I went off to IU, and I was telling my friends here this experience of going to IU thinking I was pre-med, and studying chemistry and biology and then shifting to math and physics. And I tested out of a lot of the coursework in the first couple of years. So theoretically, I should have been done in 2 years. But to my dad's dismay, it took me 6 years and then some to not get a degree. So I marched off to MIT following a professor that David and I know well, Doug Hofstetter, who was down on the campus. And I had been helping the professors of the computer science department run the computer systems. And I begged him to take me with him because he was going to do a sabbatical for Marvin Minsky, the guy who's considered to be the father of artificial intelligence. And it was just a really cool place to be at MIT and all of that. And I begged him to go. He said, well, you haven't even graduated as an undergrad. How could I consider taking you as a graduate student? So I ended up following him and his graduate student, who was a friend of mine. And I went out there and stayed a couple of weeks with that grad student and fell in love with the place. I mean, it wasn't just Marvin Minsky. It was every name in the book that anybody was talking about at that time. And so I really wanted to be there. I showed them some of the things, I could do, and they seemed to like me. So they hired me as a research scientist. And I thought, well, gee, this is not how I was thinking about it, but I could start grad school in a couple of years, or I could start a company maybe across the street. And so so as it turned out, I did start that company almost 2 years to the day later. But, the really interesting experience I had, and when you were talking about improvisation, David, it made me think of this. I was thrust into an environment that I don't know that they knew how to have employees like research scientists. And so I worked for Marvin and I worked for Patrick Winston. I can't remember in 2 years that they ever asked me to do anything. Not once. And so I was in an environment where you have the faculty and the administration and the grad students and the students all packed into this 2 or 3 floor area called the Artificial Intelligence Lab, and nobody's telling me what to do. And it took me, a couple of weeks, months to figure out which end was up. And I later found out that sort of the guiding light was, you're considered a loser until you prove otherwise. And in that environment, it's like what you were saying about improvisation. It's a blank sheet of paper, and you know, the hardest thing in the world is to take that risk of, well, what are you going to write on the sheet of paper, right? And so you know, that's really the crucible, you know, that I lived in for a couple of years, and really the reason I attribute that as a primary reason why I was able to take risks later with my entrepreneurial ventures, voicemail and Gracenote and robot racing and stem cell technology and cha-cha, the things I'm doing now. You know, all of those things I really attribute back to those skills I learned about putting yourself out there and taking risks, but not so much risk that you fail permanently, but you take risks where you fail fast and tune up, and, you know, get to a better place that no one's ever been before. And so, you know, that's what I've really spent my career doing, is taking those kinds of risks.
You've all spoken in a way that goes against the grain, I think, of common thinking about risk-taking, which is risk-taking is a solo act. You know, I'm going to jump out of a plane, or I'm going to do some risky thing, and it's all about me. And all of you have talked about parents or teammates or a congregation or family. How do we encourage the risk takers around us? What have you learned from having those folks around you? What have you learned that you could share with us about how to encourage more progressive, useful risk taking?
You know, I'll do another pitch for Lemonade Day for a second here. You know, one of the cool things that we've seen, and the program is now, you know, 4 years old, and we started, you know, there were other cities that were doing this, and we were the most successful at getting the most kids, you know, for our population in Indianapolis to try it first. So we had like 7,000, 7,500 kids that first year. Now we're at 20,000 and climbing. You know, I think we should have more like 50,000 in the community participating. But the really interesting thing is, by applying the, you know, entrepreneurship skills and giving them sort of a vehicle to do that, you can watch these kids explode in terms of, you know, their capabilities, because they're viscerally feeling what it's like to be an entrepreneur at 5 years old, 10 years old. We even had a three-year-old that was involved, and he was actually quite successful. He got like thousands of dollars. But you watch these kids, and they've got their lemonade stand set up at, you know, the library and the parks and on their, you know, just down the street from their own house. And when they first start the day, you know, they're barely even able to, you know, stop somebody walking by or stop a car. And when somebody, you know, notices the lemonade stand and walks up to it, you know, they're kind of, the kids looking at their shoes and, you know, not sure what to do next. You know, they hold out a glass of lemonade and, you know, they forget to ask for the money. but by the end of the day, like 2 or 3 hours later, they're like shouting to the top of the treetops, you know, I've got the best lemonade in town. And they've transformed in just those few hours, you know, to take those risks, you know, just like what I was watching with the dance thing at the beginning. You know, they're stretching, right? They're stretching incrementally over those few hours. And that's such an important skill to teach, you know, ourselves and our children, our grandchildren. And so, you know, that to me is why I got involved in the Lemonade Day program and brought it here. It started in Houston by a Hoosier who was from Richmond, Indiana, Mike Holdhouse. And, you know, he told me, he's an investor in Cha-Cha, and he told me about this thing, and I said, I got to do it. And we only had a couple of months, you know, to get ready for the spring. And like I said, we were, you know, first in the country in terms of adoption there. But those are the sorts of things, you know, that I'd love us to be able to hand down to our kids, you know, teach them how to fish, right?
I think I'll add a little bit to that, in that, you know, that kid, when you put a program like that out there and you see that kid, you know, really transform, they start doing something that they love. And that they enjoy that.
And they keep coming back every year.
Yeah, and to see that, you know, for me, you know, what I've done is, you know, I love racing, okay? I love racing cars. So as a female athlete, my lifespan as an athlete is so short because there's things I want to do else in my family life, right? Well, so what do I do to, you know, continue something as a job in this racing environment? And I think the key to that is that I love what I do. And I take risks because of that to be a part of that. So whether that's jumping off and starting a race team and not really having any money but my retirement, you know, that risk in itself is just a risk that I've taken because I want to do something that I really love. So when speaking to the community about taking risks, you know, it's just like those kids when they have a little bit of success and they experience how much they love that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, taking a risk is really worth it if you're taking a risk to do something that you're really going to love and be passionate about, because you'll be successful ultimately because you love it so much you won't sleep until you are.
Well, with improvisation again, that blank page haunts everybody. Basically, we've reached a time now where it is being handled on a lot of different levels. For instance, a young man who had been an ex-student of mine, Jamie Abersall, many of you will recognize him, who came up with the play-along records, which have served as a means of getting people to get involved with trying to play. But day by day in those early years, I would look and see kids ready to drop out of school because they were so frightened about not having a piece of music in front of them. Remember, we had lionized all of the people who did that, whether it was Mendelssohn or Haydn or Beethoven or Brahms, and we'd had them already involved with that, and then somebody says, all right, now, here's a blank page, play it. And inevitably, it happened that they don't play it that first few times. But pretty soon it becomes important, and also it is easier to see that there is a way to do this, that Haydn and Mozart and these people did improvisation at one time or another. So these kids who want to play, they want you to tell them how. You learn how that you give them a few scales of this, and you're ready to give up because sometimes they really are ready to give up. And then you say, all right, now try this. And by accident, it worked. And you say, so try this. By this time, they're hooked. They want to play. They want to be one of the people who everybody else looks to when it's time to play on the music. And everybody else is reading the music. And there's a poor guy who's got no music, but he's supposed to compete with those people. Doesn't take long to figure out that it can be done. I can remember very early in my improvisational world that nobody really was teaching anybody to play improvise. They would say, you'll hear it. You'll hear it. And it's like somebody did this.
Yeah. But how important do you think it is, you know, working with others, so collaboratively improvising, you know?
I think very, very much that it's very important. First of all, we now have developed techniques. First, we teach them scales. That's something they're already familiar with from playing Mozart or Haydn or whoever. We also tell them that this is the place where they will be able to play solos. A friend of mine said once that improvisation with a group is like a democracy. You have a leader who is the soloist at that particular time. Once he's done with his solo and they have run all over him trying to start before he stops, they say, all right, you're the leader now, and they have to be the background. So these methods have evolved in such a way that now I think one can say truthfully that improvisation is very easy to teach, and it's something that scared me out of my wits when I was at Christmas Alex and other places. But now I'm convinced that anybody who wants to learn to play, assuming they have some semblance of intelligence, I don't mean it negatively. So it is really difficult at first to get this done, but I think it is in the event, and I think that way of comparing it with a democracy attaches it to its American birth as far as improvisation goes. And so consequently, now I don't shy away from checking with those people who want to play but don't know how to play. They don't have anyone to teach them how. And I think that that was one thing that I had to overcome. Now it would never occur to me to tell a student, you can't do this. I spent a lot of time writing a whole lot of books in foreign language. They thought it was English, but it was a foreign language to them. And now we're starting to see, not just because of me, but Jerry Colquhart, Pat Harbison, you name it, Jamie Ebersole. Now that mystery is gone out of that. But you have to give up something, because when you took the mystery out of it, now what happens until they can play? And these are things that I'm constantly revisiting, and it's the reason why I write a lot of books, because it's easier for me to write the book than it is for me to try to teach one student every 15 minutes for the rest of my life.
Well, let's apply some of those principles to the community in which we live. We often hear that Midwesterners are not big risk takers. I sometimes say that the only thing worse for a Hoosier than being second is being first. We want somebody else to give it a shot, see if we can refine it, see if we can learn, and then step in. But I wonder if we're a little hard on ourselves. Can you think of examples of how we Hoosiers, those of us perhaps in Central Indiana or the Midwest, have taken some risks? What do those people, those times look like?
I'm always intrigued by the Hoosiers who are behind something that's innovative. I'll get interested in new technology or a movement, and I'll start researching it, and I'll discover that the person who started it was from Indiana. That's the first thing I discovered. The second thing I discovered is that they had to move to do it.
Right.
And so on one hand, I think, boy, we're doing something right. We're creating all these kind of people who are thoughtful, energetic, creative, innovative, who are willing to take risks. But there doesn't seem to be the structures to help them bring that to fruition.
I think that's right. It's like there's not the catalysts
right.
that are required here sometimes. They're coming. You have the exact targets that sell for $2.5 billion to Salesforce recently and Compendium sold. So it's starting to happen, but it wasn't here 20 years ago, at least in my tech field.
And it's just maddening, because then you look at political structures and you think, okay, what are our, what are we passionate about politically? Well, our effort this year, we're going to try to make sure that gay people can't marry and be happy. And it's just, so you think, oh, let's take that passion, let's take that energy and direct it toward a constructive goal that will elevate people. And let's do that. Let's do that because we're a passionate people. I've consistently found that to be the case for Hoosiers, that we are passionate. We do believe things deeply. So let's take that passion and let's channel it toward things that elevate the human experience and expand us and not constrict us.
So let's take that notion that you're the Hoosiers that you research had to move. You four haven't. What's kept you here?
Well, I did have to leave in order to do voicemail. But I came back, right?
Yeah. And why?
Because I like being here in Indiana, and I like, you know, how people treat each other. I like the traffic, or the lack of it, the lack of traffic. I like the spirit. So I wanted to come back here and do it. And I'm constantly challenged by those in Silicon Valley and on the East Coast. You know, why are you in a flyover state? That's what they say. And, I say because it's a great place to bring up a family. It's a great place to operate a business. You know, it's a very business-friendly climate. But I watch us, in some ways, shoot ourselves in the foot. For example, when I came back from Boston, you know, we had this daylight saving time thing where we weren't participating. And so I got engaged, you know, with the mayor, with the governor, with the legislature to get it changed. Because how was I ever going to operate a business here when we weren't on the same time as anybody else, right? So, it was causing a lot of friction. I'm told that, you know, one of the reasons we're not a hub, an airport hub, is because while we were at the center of the population, which has now moved west a bit now, but at the time when we could have been a hub, the fact that we were not on the same time as anybody else really did, you know, shoot ourselves in the foot, you know, there. There's another opportunity that's upon us right now, besides daylight saving time, to get nonstop flights. And in fact, there is one that has been put in place by the governor, the mayor, IEDC. They've done some incredible work. Scott Dorsey over at Exact Target has led the charge on this. And it's incredible progress that we will now have a direct nonstop flight starting in January to Silicon Valley. Not so much because we get there, although that's important, and so that we can take, you know, vacations in San Francisco, but so that the money in Silicon Valley, which is where most of it is, can come here and invest in our little startup companies. And hopefully we get to keep some of them here and not just sell them all off. And so that's really important. And the people that would interview for the jobs to be CEOs and CMOs and engineers in our companies, they might have been, you know, trained and educated at Purdue or IU or DePauw or Notre Dame or, you know, other Indiana schools, but then they had to go off to get those jobs, you know, kind of what we were talking about before. You got to go somewhere else to do it. Well, they might have done that, but now they've got a family. You know, they got 5 or 10 years of work experience, and they got a family, and they really don't want to bring up their family in San Francisco or Boston necessarily. They're not bad places, but, you know, having spent a lot of time, I'd rather bring my family up here. And they would too, but they can't even get here to do the interview. It takes 3 days, right? So it's important that we get this nonstop flight. And by the way, the job's not done. And so we collectively need to be talking to the mayor and the governor and IEDC about, well, wait a minute, what are those flight times? How, you know, what time of day does it go? Does it benefit, you know, both us and the people in San Francisco and Silicon Valley to come here and do those interviews or to sit on a board in Indiana and be able to wake up in the morning, get on a plane, have your board meeting in Indiana and get back and have, you know, dinner or at least tuck your kids in, you know, maybe at 9 or 10 o'clock, you know, back there? Is it possible? So we're not, the flights are not quite structured that way yet. And if you want to offline with me, I can be more specific. But there is still work to be done to get that right. Those are the catalysts that are required in order, you know, to have us, you know, be able to take more risks. Because otherwise, it's just too hard to take the risks here. It's like wearing 2 straitjackets, right? As opposed to if you lived in Silicon Valley, if you lived in Cambridge, Mass., you know, where it's more fluid. Right, and you can have improvisation much easier and riff off of each other. That's what's happening with Google and Facebook and Twitter and right and all the little startups.
Well, one thing that came out of all of this that was so striking was that a few people came up with the notion that nature abhors a vacuum, and wherever there's a vacuum, something will take place. It didn't matter where it takes place, but it can take place. And in Indiana, that's really what was happening, because a lot of the energy that has put improvisation on the map and put it in a situation where it had to be taught because the students are demanding it would be taught, that it's a lot easier when you start with the premise that nature abhors a vacuum. Wherever there's a missing book that somebody should have, somebody's got to write it. If somebody's going to be a player and going to be, they've got to write that or do whatever's there. And it means not being able to give it up so easily when you didn't have a starting place, or at least your imagination would tell you that if a book is not got, if anything is missing out of the book, there's a vacuum, put it in it. If nobody else has done, even when you put it upside down wrong, it'll get somebody active about fixing it so they can pop you upside the head.
Sarah, there was a vacuum in racing in terms of women in racing. Is there anything about place that was a catalyst for your being able to take the risk to do what you've done?
Well, I mean, it's Indianapolis. The Indy 500 is here, so this is where I had to come. I'm actually not a Hoosier, but now I am. And I like to say I'm an adopted Hoosier, so anyone who asks me where I'm from, you know, it's Indianapolis. And, you know, just from a community perspective, one of the things that, you know, I've been able to do as a part of, you know, this career I've taken in racing is the National Women's Business Council, which is a federally appointed council out of D.C. that reports to the President and Congress, asked me to be on this 15-member council. I'm thinking, what in the world do they want a retired race car driver / team owner in this position? I don't know anything about, you know, access to capital and all these things that women entrepreneurs are having trouble with. And in being on this council, seeing some of the women entrepreneurs that are in Indiana, I mean, just going to the Indiana Governor's Conference for women, I think it was Tuesday. I don't know, I've kind of been around the country this week, but, and seeing how many excited, young, enthusiastic women entrepreneurs there are in this state. And then knowing some of the studies that the NWBC has done on, you know, self-limitations. They maybe don't think that they're, you know, capable of being there because, you know, studies have shown that a male will take a D as a passing grade, whereas a female will only take an A or a B as acceptable. And so there's self-limitation problems. There's, you know, access to capital, access to the workplace. And, but you see a lot of hungry, energetic, female entrepreneurs. And being from, you know, this racing industry that is, you know, born and supported here, one of the things that I've told myself that I need to do is be better as a support mechanism within the community. And I think the community can also play a part in that. What I do is a very public, industry. And so people, you know, can support me quite easily by, you know, oh wow, first female to do this, that, or the other, and fastest, whatever. It's easy to say that's a great job. But I think what's important is that there's this whole big group of female entrepreneurs and young kids at the lemonade stand who want to do that. And, you know, it's our job to support them however we can in what they're trying to do. And as a community, you know, I think that sometimes we lack in that area. You know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, seeing all these different entrepreneurs in the last couple of weeks, it's like, man, it's there. We just need to support them somehow.
Ideas for the somehow?
I've created a problem, haven't I?
Looks like we're dancing around it, because eventually it has to be said that what happened in 1927 in Indianapolis when Christopher Silas School was built, because the Klan had said blacks were not going to go to school with whites here. And it's not entirely different from where you're coming from, because, again, a minority having to deal with a majority. And the irony of Crispus Attucks, which was the first person to be killed in the Civil War, and in 1927, the Klan and other people forced the issue about mixture in the schools. And out of all of those things, I think of how many good things there were. When I went back to my 2,000th or 2,000,000th, with the rest of the class from that time, and we had, like, you know, the celebration and all that, and found out that if you hold to the lines tight enough, you'll manage, because what happened, virtually most of the teachers, or many of the teachers at Christmas Addicts, had advanced degrees that weren't available to everybody or they had not used. There were people now who had to really depend on their ingenuity and their mindset to be able to succeed. And we watched them, not just the ones who became, a part of the, what is that group from, the airmen that I'm talking about?
Tuskegee Airmen.
Damn, everybody knew it. Yeah. Yeah. And so it shows that sometimes necessity can force this to happen. Then along came Dr. King and put some icing on it. I was telling people today, I joined all of that, and I can remember when I had an afro this big. Not only the afro, but I had all of the stuff that went with it. I had the beads and the whole thing. Until the first day at Indiana University, when I saw the dean there, and he saw me with the high heel shoes, the jewelry around my neck, the afro, and he walked up to me and it was marvelous. He said, "Why, David, what a marvelous costume." I changed clothes.
Well, you may have been taking a risk in that outfit. And we often talk about risk-taking as a virtue. But I'm wondering, what about the risks we seem to take that may not be virtues? Are there instances where we're taking risks that really are at our peril? The environment, the economy, can you think of misguided risks that we're currently taking as a society?
I'm increasingly concerned about the rate of imprisonment in America. And we're doing it ostensibly to make ourselves safe. But what we're doing is removing parents from households and subjecting children to horrific deprivation and psychological damage because the person they love is no longer able to be present in their lives. And we're imprisoning people for things that in many nations aren't illegal. So we're doing this because we have perceived that they're a threat. But the very consequence of doing that is really increasing the risk of future jeopardy as more and more people feel alienated and embittered toward the society that did this to them and their family, chiefly the poor, which in this country are represented in our prisons way out of proportion to their actual number in society. So that's one thing. We just have to stop doing this. And it began I remember learning about this, having a professor who was real passionate about this, for-profit prisons. And I said at the time, that's a wonderful idea. And he became very upset with me. And he said, it's a terrible idea. Because of the business model, they can only make a profit if more behavior is criminalized. And we'll be eventually locking people up for things we didn't used to do so someone can make money. And it has come true in this country. And it is evil. It is evil. And it's done because we perceive that we're at risk if we don't do it. We've been convinced that it's risky not to do that. And quite the opposite is true, that doing that is placing us not only at current risk, but at future risk.
I think that's an important point that, it's an important point that, you know, risk is relative. It's always relative to something else. So like the environment, you know, we can stick with status quo and, you know, it probably decreases all kinds of risks. But, you know, looming out in the long term is, you know, we've got ourselves a situation that may not be fixable. We don't know, right? We don't know that a 4% or a 4-degree rise in temperature on the planet won't irreversibly, you know, put us in disaster. And while we've lived for, you know, thousands of years with, there's, you know, always another chance, you know, no matter how we screw things up, that may not always be the case when we start, you know, changing things over a period of 50 or 100 years that are irreversible, you know, big holes in the atmosphere that, you know, can't be reversed. So, you know, I think this concept, whether it be prisons or environmental issues, you know, I think risk is relative, and really what we have to be about is assessing those risks. You know, what are the downsides? Let's not have a blind eye to what the downsides might be. Let's stare into it and assess and, you know, figure out how we get ourselves back, you know, on the right path.
David or Sarah, any risks not worth taking that you think we're taking right now?
I'm sure there are many. I'm trying just to flip through the 5x8 cards or whatever in my brain.
There's lots of risks on the Hill that, you know, that some of the council members see and fight day to day, but, you know, by the time that you see the long term of that, you know, we won't be here anymore. You know, I think, gosh, it's just outweighing what are the negatives. You know, I think that's something that we all do when we look at, you know, what risk we're going to take. You know, we look at the positives, but you always have to look at the negatives and the downfalls of it. And I think as each and every one of us takes a risk, you know, you don't want to be blind to that. Because the outstanding effects of it could affect others. And how does your risk affect others and your family as you do it? It's really great to go 230, but what happens if I don't come back from that? What's my daughter going to do? And I think we all, as we take those risks, we need to outweigh the negative and be comfortable with that. If we're comfortable with that, then we move forward. But if we're not comfortable with that or it affects others in a negative way, then you really have to weigh on that.
Well, let's turn a few questions over to the audience, and I would encourage you to really make it a question. And if you wouldn't mind, if you could stand where you are, and I may repeat the question for someone back. Yes, sir.
One of the things that we're dealing with here in Indianapolis right now is the levee wall. One of the problems that have come out of when you talk about taking the back downside of risk, all the good things that come out of building new businesses and new growth, all the hard surfaces we create, that there's no place for this water and this rain to be absorbed. All of a sudden, you talk about floods, it could be things that you never would have thought would happen. Now they're going to happen, very likely, because of this. How do you, as an entrepreneur, as a leader, take a risk and know, you know, these risks are there, that balancing the positives and the negatives when they're brought to your attention, how do you make sure you're doing the right thing for the community? I'm thinking of things also in your area of governance, of how fast these things can go on them. So the downside, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I think it's all about education and making sure that we as a community are getting ourselves properly educated, and there's usually going to be, you know, different people on different sides. You know, there are probably maybe business interests or other interests that, you know, would be, you know, for or against. And I think it's that public debate and making sure that it is truly public, and you know, we need to encourage that because you can oftentimes optimize for the current situation, but not be looking down the road. And so when there's a few voices out there, the outliers, they're saying, oh, but wait a minute, what about in 20 years when there's so many hard surfaces in this particular example? you know, that we have to contend with, you know, these issues that are going to cost us millions, you know, to fix, if it's even fixable, right? Because we've got, you know, in effect, you know, tsunami, typhoon type of, you know, environmental issues coming to play here, right here in the Midwest. You know, so I do think it's important that we all play our role in raising our hand and saying, well, hold on a minute, did you think about this? And then, you know, we, as a business owner, you know, that's why I do get involved in things like daylight saving time or nonstop flights, you know, what some have called the nerd bird flights, you know, to Silicon Valley, which could expand to other cities too, you know, that we want to be connected to. And so, you know, I'm constantly trying to keep informed. You know, the one you just mentioned, I actually am not very informed about, but I'll go get informed and figure out, you know, what side should I take? And then I'll try to contribute my voice as all of us should.
Oh, I have a story about that. Our Quaker meeting built a new meeting house. And we went to a government board because they had to approve the plans. And we said we prefer not to have a retention pond. We would rather use, instead of asphalt, porous asphalt, which you can now use. It's more expensive, but it is available, and it is cheaper than doing conventional asphalt and then having to create a series of drains for a retention pond, and it's much more ecologically sound. And they turned down our request. And I said, this is more ecologically sound and prevents the issue of runoff because it filters through. And they said, nope. So the research was there. Engineers, scientists have said, this is the way to go. This is the wave of the future. And we weren't able to persuade a local group of people who had not taken the time and effort to learn about that to approve this.
And was it more expensive?
It was more expensive. It would have been equal. By the time we had to construct a retention pond with conventional asphalt, it cost the same as if we could have used porous asphalt. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our concern was ecological, that this was much, that it reduced runoff, so it would lessen the chance of flood, and would act as a natural filter.
So is that an education issue and getting enough constituency, you know, to be up in arms about it? Is that really why it failed to prevail?
Yeah, we took data to them and magazine articles to read, research journals, made no difference. But it's being used everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And to
me, that feels like it is, you know, getting the education out there and,
yeah,
you know, returning to the 60s and, you know, having, yeah, sit-ins and whatever it takes, right?
So. But the thing about it is if we start using this stuff in about 25 to 30 years, we've solved the runoff problem, mm-hmm, because it doesn't run off. It filters through just like it did when it was just grass. Yeah.
I think it's an interesting mix we have here, and isn't it ironic we're sitting in the largest public library in the state with knowledge literally on the shelves all around us, but it's not just knowledge, is it, or education. It's advocacy. It's finding new ways to communicate the same message.
I think it's finding a solution, really. I mean, just in hearing you talk, you know, when you assess your risk, the positives and the negatives, when you find out what the negatives are, you have to research the solution before you take the risk so that you kind of have a game plan as to when it does happen because you know it's going to happen. So in bringing that back to the risk side of the discussion, you know, it's knowing the negatives and, okay, what am I going to do about those, and sort of having A, B, and C solutions for it. And like you said, it's not just one solution. It's not being narrow-minded and, well, this is the only thing that I can do, because that may not be the end all, but just having a game plan for that is important.
Scott, I've heard you say in other occasions that a part of moving ahead is understanding the other person's position. In some ways, risk-taking requires an unselfish posture, in the sense of how do I understand the other, whether, and I think this goes back to jazz, right? How am I listening to what this other person is doing in order for me to be a part of it? Is that right?
I think that comes back to having the conversation, really getting educated. And one thing I was going to mention, and I don't know enough about this particular situation, but it's a good example. But if everybody were educated on the issues, and if you thought that there were going to be runoff problems in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, attribute the downside of that risk that we're taking on by not fixing it the right way now. Attribute that downside to those who are getting the economic benefit, now. And the more we can do, if you get educated about it, you can start to do that. And so then maybe better decisions get made, because to some extent I'm believing bad decisions get made because they're optimizing for, one side of the equation and forgetting about the rest. And so how do we better, get education and then, attribute that risk, so that everybody's interests are aligned. I find that, helps a lot when you're having it. I forget what situation we were talking about, Kevin, where understanding the other person's point of view is essential, because, then you're, sitting in their shoes from which to, make your arguments or, to have the debate. So that's important for understanding. But then also, as we get further educated, make sure that we're, aligning interests, right?
There was a question way back in the corner there. Yes, sir.
Yes, my question, comments are directed to Ms. Fisher. I'm over 60 years old, and as such, I've been a long time racing fan, seen 1,400, 1,500, and I wanted to know, Ms. Fisher, why did you opt to leave as a driver at age of, I believe it was 33, and is this actually because you accomplished that everything being a driver that you knew about back then, or was it a decision personal, like for example marriage? And also, what do you think about the future now of IndyCar, now that the rules have been changed, by new officers at the top of IndyCar? What do you think about that future? Thank you.
Well, thank you for being a part of 40 or 50 Indy 500s. I've only been a part of 15, so I got a long ways to go. And the first time I saw the place was in the tour bus, so fan at heart. As a driver, there were many reasons that led to stepping out of the race car. And I'll start with my family, because that's probably the most important. When I married Andy at the end of 2007, we kind of had this idea in the back of the mind that, about 3 years, give or take, was when I'd probably hang it up, just because, we wanted to start a family, and we had that in the back of our minds in this crazy mess of racing that we all, become a lifestyle around. And then, I started the team with my husband, and it was great, and we started small. We ran the Indy 500, and luckily had a partner come in. We ran two more races that year, so it started 3, then 6, then 10. Races. And the more our company grew, the harder that I found it to become, to be a CEO, to be a successful leader, to run a business, to run the books. I did the accounting, I did the sales, I did the marketing. And then to also be an athlete and train 2 hours a day and run road courses and, condition my hands and work with engineers and try and set cars up and silly things like that. It got to the point where I started making small mistakes because, and we talked about this earlier, the focus of a race car driver is very intense. Decisions are made at a car that's going faster than the length of a football field in less than a second. So you have to be very switched on. And so it was kind of like, okay, my husband and I talked about this 3-year idea we had in the back of our mind. We have this race team, which is now a platform for me to be involved in racing. Post driving, which I'm very lucky to have, because racing is such a lifestyle for me that I took 1 year off and I didn't know what I was going to do. Midlife crisis at 26 is not fun. And, you know, it just got to the point where I saw new cars coming on the horizon and really wanting to see my team be successful without me leading it up. And so then, you know, in trying to find a replacement, it's like, oh, who do I hire to run, you know, half the season or three-fourths the season? And that's when I started talking to Ed Carpenter, whose value of family was just outstanding. Him and his wife, they have three kids. They're a wonderful family. And, you know, I knew that this fan base that had supported me as far as, you know, a community when I made these decisions to take risks and, you know, drive and start a team and, you know, a community that supported me when I had no money, when I maxed out all my credit cards to buy the last set of axles to race the Indy 500 in 2008. They gave me $100 bills at a time and, you know, in an effort that was sort of viral on their own, raised over 50 grand as a sponsor. My fans were my sponsor in 2008. So that was a very critical decision for me, was, you know, who was going to fill that seat. And so all these things weighing in the back of my mind, I got Ed to commit to driving for me because I knew the fans would appreciate his family values and the family culture that we held. I knew these new cars were on the horizon, so I had to have a plan in place for that, which I did with Mr. Hartman. And so I felt confident that everything was going to be okay, and then I decided to have a family. So now I have a 2-year-old daughter, Zoe, who loves racing. I am so screwed. Actually, my mom did really well with all this risk that I took my whole life. Other than the time that I decided to race these little enduro go-karts. I don't know, it's a cart that you race on your back. It's like a luge with a motor, right? And you race it like Daytona Speedway, and you're 120 miles an hour at 12 years old. Kind of, my mom wasn't real happy about that, but IndyCar she was fine with, and just a little bit of vodka and Diet Coke, and she was great to go. So I'll have to ask Mom how much vodka she had.
That's right. At the risk of missing some other questions, let me say we'll have a quota of one question to answer.
I say real quick, though, on the IndyCar, just so that I don't leave him hanging? I think IndyCar is in a great place. Mark Miles has done a fantastic job with people. And, you know, business is all about people, and sporting is as well. So I think he's made some great decisions here recently from the business side, and I'm really excited to still be a part of the sport.
All right, here.
Does our educational system now promote innovation and creativity? And if not, what changes would you suggest?
I only have a 2-year-old. I'm not there yet.
I'm sure I didn't hear the question.
The question was, does our current educational system promote innovation and creativity? And if not, what suggestions would you make? In 45 seconds or less.
So I'll take a start on that. Okay. I have five boys, and at various ages from 7 months to 21. And and the what I'm seeing is, to me, I've always felt like, you know, K through 8 is the most important, and maybe K through 3rd is maybe the most important time for education. And it's where you learn, you know, how you're going to approach learning, right? So are you going to be a problem solver? Are you going to think outside the box? Are you going to take risks and learn how to fail fast and, you know, keep the stuff that worked and throw away the stuff that didn't and, you know, make the next iteration? You know, you're going to do that through life and everything that you do. And so teaching that is why I got involved with things like Lemonade Day. But anything that, you know, that supports that kind of approach of, you know, thinking outside the box and sort of taking it on yourself, as opposed to things like rote memorization or whatever. I mean, remember, there were times in the SAT where you couldn't use your calculator. You know, I suspect there'll be a time with the SAT where you're allowed to use Cha-Cha if you want, for the facts, but you know, it's really going to be testing problem solving. Like, not when was the Gettysburg Address, but why was it, right? So, I mean, that's what I think we have to get at in education.
If I had an opportunity to, my wife and I have this conversation all the time. She's a school librarian whose degree is not in library science. It's in computer science. So we have this game. What would you do if you were the school principal and could hire anybody you wanted? And I would hire people who were passionate about something rather than people who were educated about something.
Amen.
So when I put out an interview to people, I wouldn't just look at education majors. I would try to buttonhole somebody who I knew ate up math and science or loved music. But maybe that wasn't their vocation, but that was their avocation, and they brought a real passion to it. And I'd say, hey, can I talk you into coming to school for 3 days a week and teaching these kids and being with these kids? That's what I'd do. I'd go after passion, not training.
I think to add to it is my mom's a teacher in Ohio, and she's always kind of grabbing my ear about, she has a bunch of paperwork to fill out and how that really limits her creativity with her class. She teaches computers and, you know, she has all these kind of, she has kind of a, I think they have a general lesson plan that they have to follow. But my mom is that passionate teacher that I can't get to move to Indiana to see her granddaughter. She loves her kids too much. And she goes above and beyond. She buys her own school, like classroom books and study. But she spends so much time filling out this, you know, paperwork that's legislative as far as like what they're doing and how they're doing it, instead of using her time to creatively develop ways for her kids to learn about the computer sciences, that, you know, I think that's one thing that can be done to, I guess, help those kids learn more and be more educated and just have better experiences.
And what I'm hearing all of you say is that the risk is we haven't created the culture, haven't created an environment where those kind of things perhaps can be as robust as they might be given other requirements, other competing interests.
Right. It's the exception, not the rule. Yep. Yeah.
Back in the far corner, you had your hand up. Well, then try for a question. That'll help us all out.
Congress and the United States Senate allowed a bill that says unlimited. Corporations are actually people, which has opened the floodgates for way too much money in our government. How can we continue this government with knowing that people can be bought and are bought every day that are passing our laws and expect this democracy to survive?
Well, I think that's a question of unanticipated risk, is that that when that process, which didn't happen overnight, but when that process was allowed not only to begin years ago, decades ago, maybe centuries ago, and then became enshrined in legal doctrine, What we didn't anticipate, some people did and talked about it, what we didn't anticipate was quickly enough was the slow erosion of citizenship and participatory democracy. And we will pay dramatically for that. And when we begin to suffer sufficiently, then it will stop. But not until.
Let's go back over here. Yes.
I just have a quick question. When you're weighing out kind of the pros and cons of a risk, maybe more of a personal risk than a financial risk, and maybe something that doesn't affect the environment for years and years, how far do you let yourself kind of spiral with the negatives that could happen before you say, that's enough, I have to get back to my passion and what I want to do? Do you give yourself a time, you know, almost limit of I'm getting too out of control in the negatives that could happen?
I mean, the racing industry is so short-lived, and there's, you know, silly season every year that 10 years is like an eternity to look at. So kind of when we look at where we want to be, 10 years is sort of our goal. If we can be where we want to be and take this risk and have the end all know like what's going to happen at that point, then we would be happy with that for our industry. But our industry is so different in that things are, I mean, it's just so much change and sponsors come and go, and you know, to hang with that, the durability of it. You know, I've really found that the way that our culture is and our race team and really differentiating ourselves has allowed us to sustain who we are and what we're doing. So 10 years, I guess, is a few.
So you were asking about personal risk?
Yeah, but, maybe personal risk for buying a car, bad decision,
yeah.
How long does it affect you?
Well, that's different. Yeah, you've committed yourself when you bought the car, but you know, when do you bail? Well, so for me, in terms of, you know, the personal, as opposed to my corporate, you know, my companies, my entrepreneurial ventures, as opposed to that kind of risk, more of my personal risk, I think I do better by, you know, putting myself not in stupid risk, but, you know, taking intelligent risk on certain things. And I find that, you know, necessity really is the mother of invention. So putting myself out there on the cliff, you know, and needing to, you know, walk along that cliff to save myself, you know, get around the corner of the building and back in the window. you know, it's that's an important place for me to be personally, not all the time, but a bunch of the time. And, you know, how long do you wait on things? You know, I guess for me, it really depends on the situation. If it's a car, I'm probably not going to wait that long, right? If I don't like my car, if I invested in something and I find, you know, the risk I took in investing in that thing was wrong, I'll correct that pretty fast. But if it's a career choice, you know, I'll give that decades, right? So, you know, to hang out there and, you know, and Cha-Cha, for example, has been around 8 years since I thought of it, you know, giving a speech to the, you know, National Academies of Sciences and wanting to tell CEOs and chairmen of Silicon Valley, like, what's coming next in the next 3 years. And I was Googling it and Yahooing it and trying to figure out what I would say in my speech to impress them and not coming up with much. And so I, you know, figured out that I should call my venture capital friends or my chief technology officer or some of the companies I'd already done, like Voicemail and Gracenote. And they would invariably, within 30 seconds, tell me, oh, well, just go to this website. It's a really cool thing. And it was, right? And so, you know, the vision of Cha-Cha is to be able to do that for all of us on any topic at any time and get, you know, connect you in real time with someone who's an expert and can, like, weigh in on gardening or, you know, prostate cancer or basketball or whatever the topic is, you know, that you could, you know, be in conversation. So I'm taking a huge personal risk, and it might take decades. And by the way, nobody solved it yet, not Google, not anybody. So, you know, that one I'm willing to sit out there at personal risk for a long while because I believe and I'm passionate about it.
I fret about decisions for as long as my wife will let me. And then when she's frustrated, I say, okay, I'll do this and not that.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. You know, getting that, I mean, you were saying it in jest maybe, but it's true. If you have somebody close to you,
sure,
who cares, I think that's a really important,
absolutely,
way to assess, well, how long should I let this risk sit out there? Because,
yeah,
you're blinded by what you see yourself.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, my wife, you know, has great influence over,
absolutely,
my decisions about how long I let things hang out there.
Absolutely.
Well, wouldn't that make real sense when you talk about things that have waited, they have waited? Helmet to helmet hitting in football, and boxers who end up like Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody is perhaps thinking, whether it's with our personal problem, but somebody's out there thinking most of the time about those things, and it's cost them a lot of money in boxing. We know that, and in football too. But somebody thought that it was smart, that it was intelligent, and that it was in the best interest of humans.
have time for one more question, and then I would say you may want to look on YouTube to Carl Sagan, who talks about a risk worth taking 1,000 million years from now. Back here toward the back. Yeah.
First, I want to thank you all for coming here, and a very good evening to all of you. This question is for Sarah. Sarah, I want to thank you for everything that you have done for each one of us. My question to you is, the biggest risk that a woman in India takes is by ending her life and also abandoning her daughter on the pavement. My question to you is, what are your views? Because you're an American and the culture is different. How can we improve women's lives in India, and how could we solve these issues? Kindly give my message to the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, who is an advocate for women's issues, and also to Mrs. Jill Biden. I would like to sit down with both of them and also with you, Sarah, and discuss how we can improve the lives of other women, because they don't have any rights in India. Kindly answer this question. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Sure. Well, you know, I'll just get it out there that I never really hung the whole, you know, I'm a woman in a race car driving world hat. Because for me, it was all about the bottom line. Did I perform? Was I in a position, and was I able to win races? Was I competitive? Did I deserve the opportunity? And if the answer is yes, then I belong here. And I really don't care what my neighbor says about that. Because I'm competitive and my peers respect me for that ability. If I can't, and this goes back to 2010, road course racing happens, and I'm just not really that great at it, so I go hire someone to do it. you know, it's sad that there's other places in this world that don't support that, because I feel 110% that regardless if you're a man or a woman, or maybe not a monkey, but in the driving world, yeah. Your mental capacity, women are very smart and contribute a lot to our community. And, you know, in solving India, I have an India doctor that delivered Zoe, if that helps. I don't, but, you know, it's all about education.
Well, I think, you know, it's bad, and I agree with that. But it is improving at I won't use the word improving. It's changing at a fast rate now. So the divorce rate is, you know, from what it was at less than 1%, you know, a decade or two ago, it's now, you know, a handful of percent. I mean, that's, you know, hundreds of percent of growth in a decade. So that's sort of the good news, in that you can be, you know, not that divorce is good, but it's saying that change is happening, and that women are starting to be able to have high profile positions in society there. And so the good news is that there's momentum. You're not just at a dead stop at a stoplight. You've actually moved off center, and you know, you the work that it sounds like you're starting to do is important work, because you can get your shoulder behind the wheel and really push. And that's what we all must do on the things we are passionate about.
And so let me ask you, as your final word to all of us, as we're getting ready to leave here and the festival ends on risk, what is a risk worth taking that each of you would commend to us as we leave this festival?
Well, for me, it's all about passion and what you love doing. So for me, taking any risk that I evaluate, if I love doing what it is that I'm going to risk, then it's a no-brainer. So if there's something that's sitting in the back of your mind, like, man, I wish I could start that yogurt shop, or, you know, whatever it is, if it's that risk that you just truly enjoy and want to feel empowered about, then it's worth taking, you're going to be successful at it if you take it.
I would write a cure for cancer.
So do I.
Good.
It is natural that we want to be thought well of, and that we want people to like us. I would suggest that the risk worth taking is to stop caring about the good opinion of others.
I think I would merge that with what Sarah and David have said here. You know, stepping outside the comfort zone and, you know, look inside yourself for the thing that you're passionate about and don't really care what everybody else thinks. You know, go tackle it, right? Don't waste another second, minute, day. You know, go do it. And encourage those around you to do the same. That's what I would challenge you to do in terms of risk. And it will feel uncomfortable, and that's good.
Well, the hope of the festival is that we won't simply talk about good ideas, but find a way to embody them, to encourage others in doing that. And I think with this panel, we've had just that, not only in their being willing to share their own passions, to share their own experiences, and to commend to us dreams as lofty as curing cancer and risks as deeply intimate and as personal as the passion that wakes us up in the morning. So let's all join together in thanking these four wonderful risk takers of our community.